I remember standing in that apartment doorway, knowing before anyone said it out loud that whatever had happened inside that room was not sudden, not random, and not the kind of violence that arrives uninvited. Because the signs were already there, in the way the furniture was displaced, without signs of forced entry, and the way the light from a phone screen still glowed against the wall long after it should have gone dark, and in the silence that follows familiarity when it turns lethal, which is something you learn to recognize only after you have seen it enough times, because there is a difference between chaos and intimacy gone wrong, and that difference lives in small details, like the absence of defensive damage to the doorframe, the placement of personal items, where someone would never leave them, unless they believe they were safe, and the quiet persistence of digital traces that continue recording even after a body stops moving, traces that would later show a pattern, not of chance but of escalation. Not of strangers, but of someone already inside her life, already part of her routine, already close enough to be trusted, which is how I came to know the case of Amanda Fan. When I was assigned the case, the first thing I reviewed was not the crime scene photos or the autopsy report, but the initial call log, because those entries tend to reveal more about the structure of a case than people realize, especially in incidents involving interpersonal violence, where the timeline before the act often matters more than the moment itself. The call came in from a concerned friend who had not heard back after repeated messages, which immediately framed the response as a welfare check rather than an act of crime, a distinction that affects everything from the number of officers dispatched to the assumptions made when approaching the scene. Amanda Pham was 20 years old, living in a modest apartment complex in California that catered primarily to students and young professionals, and from what we could confirm through lease records and interviews, she had moved there less than a year earlier. She worked part-time, attended classes, and maintained a social circle that was digitally active but physically dispersed, a pattern that became relevant once we started reconstructing her final days through phone records and application data that documented contact far more reliably than memory ever could. Before the homicide, there were no police reports filed by Amanda related to domestic violence, no restraining orders, and no open investigations tied to her name, which is not unusual in cases involving dating violence, particularly among younger victims, who often interpret escalating behavior as personal conflict rather than criminal conduct. Friends described her as private but communicative, someone who would share concerns through messages rather than in person, which meant that much of what she experienced existed primarily in digital form rather than in formal complaints. The person she had been dating was known to her social circle, and while I will not detail unverified characterizations, it was confirmed through multiple interviews that the relationship had experienced tension in the weeks leading up to her death. That tension was reflected in communication frequency, tone changes in text messages, and periods of silence that coincided with known disputes, all of which were later corroborated through device extraction conducted under warrant. On the day before her body was discovered, Amanda followed a routine that on its surface appeared unremarkable. She attended classes, returned home, and communicated with friends using the same platform she used daily, which allowed us to establish a baseline for her activity patterns. That baseline became critical when we later identified deviations, because in digital investigations, absence is often as informative as presence, especially when a person who typically responds within minutes suddenly stops altogether. When officers arrived at the apartment for the welfare check, there were no signs of forced entry, which immediately narrowed the scope of potential suspects, since opportunistic intrusions almost always leave some trace of entry damage. The door was locked, and access was gained through the property manager, a detail documented on body-worn camera footage that later became part of the evidentiary record. Inside, Amanda was found in her bedroom with multiple stab wounds, and based on the position of the body and the distribution of bloodstains, the attack had occurred in that room rather than elsewhere in the apartment. There was no evidence of a prolonged struggle across multiple rooms, which suggested either an element of surprise or a confrontation that escalated rapidly once initiated, both of which align with patterns commonly seen in intimate partner violence cases. The medical examiner would later confirm that the wounds were inflicted by a sharp-edged weapon consistent with a knife, and while the weapon itself was not immediately recovered at the scene, there were no signs of robbery, reinforcing the assessment that the motive was personal rather than acquisitive. Her personal belongings, including electronics and identification, were intact, which further reduced the likelihood of an unknown assailant. From an investigative standpoint, the absence of forced entry, combined with the nature of the injuries and the victim's relationship history, directed attention towards someone who had access, permission, or both. That determination was not based on assumption, but on statistical and experiential analysis derived from similar cases, a framework that guides initial investigative focus without replacing evidence. As we began formal interviews, it became clear that Amanda had expressed concerns to friends about her relationship, particularly about communication that had become controlling in tone. Though no explicit threats were documented prior to the homicide, those communications, once recovered and authenticated, would become central to understanding the progression of events, not because they explained motive in a speculative sense, but because they established a pattern of interaction that contextualized the final encounter. What stood out early was how much of Amanda's life, like that of many young adults, was recorded passively by devices designed for convenience rather than documentation, a reality that now defines modern investigations. Location services, message timestamps, and application metadata created a parallel narrative to the physical one, allowing us to reconstruct movements and interactions with a level of precision that would not have been possible a decade earlier. By the end of the first day, we had secured the apartment, initiated forensic processing, and obtained preliminary warrants for digital evidence, setting the stage for an investigation that would rely as much on servers and storage as on fingerprints and bloodstain patterns. At that point, what had changed was not yet fully understood, but the foundation for uncovering it was already in place. The turning point in the investigation came not from a witness statement or a recovered weapon, but from the digital timeline established through synchronized data pulled from Amanda's phone, her applications, and network records obtained through lawful process. This data allowed us to narrow the window of the homicide with a degree of accuracy that physical indicators alone could not provide, particularly given the lack of eyewitnesses. The last outgoing communication from Amanda occurred within hours of her death, and the content, while not explicitly alarming, reflected an emotional exchange with the person she had been dating. The tone shift, documented through linguistic analysis rather than subjective interpretation, showed increased frequency and urgency, a pattern that often precedes in-person confrontations in cases involving relationship conflict. Location data placed the individual of interest in proximity to Amanda's apartment during the relevant time frame, a fact corroborated by cell tower pings and application-level GPS records that aligned across multiple platforms. This convergence was significant because isolated data points can be misleading, but consistency across independent systems strengthens reliability. One of the most critical pieces of evidence came from a short video recorded on Amanda's phone, either intentionally or inadvertently, during the final interaction. The video did not capture the act itself, but it recorded audio and partial visuals that placed the suspect inside the apartment, providing temporal confirmation of presence without relying on inference. The file metadata confirmed its creation time, and forensic analysis verified that it had not been altered. This recording, often referred to as the tape within the investigative team, was handled with care due to its sensitive nature, but its evidentiary value was substantial. It documented the suspect's voice and established that he was present at a time consistent with the medical examiner's estimated time of death, eliminating alternative explanations for his location during that window. Following the identification of this evidence, the suspect was located and detained for questioning. During the interview, statements were made that were later compared against the digital record, and discrepancies were noted, not as proof in themselves, but as indicators that warranted further scrutiny. In modern investigations, inconsistencies between statements and data often reveal more than either source alone. Search warrants executed on the suspect's devices revealed communications that mirrored those found on Amanda's phone, confirming bidirectional exchanges and establishing a mutual timeline. The content showed escalating conflict, but did not contain explicit admissions, underscoring the importance of corroborative evidence rather than reliance on confessions. Forensic examination of the apartment yielded trace evidence consistent with the suspect's presence, including fingerprints in areas aligned with the digital timeline. While such evidence alone might be explained by prior visits, its significance lay in its alignment with the time frame established through electronic data. The knife believed to have been used was later recovered from a location associated with the suspect, and while forensic testing was required to establish its connection definitively, its characteristics matched the wound analysis provided by the medical examiner. This recovery was documented meticulously to preserve chain of custody and evidentiary integrity. Throughout this phase, the investigation remained focused on verified facts, resisting the temptation to fill gaps with assumptions, particularly given the public attention the case began to attract once the arrest was made. Maintaining that discipline was essential, both for the integrity of the case and for the respect owed to the victim. By the time charges were filed, the narrative was no longer speculative, but evidentiary, built from converging data streams that collectively established presence, opportunity, and action within a legally defensible framework. The conclusion of the case was not marked by revelation, but by confirmation, as each piece of evidence was examined in court and validated through adversarial testing. The digital records were authenticated, the forensic analyses presented, and the timeline reconstructed in a manner consistent with established investigative standards. Amanda Pham's death was formally classified as a homicide resulting from dating violence, a designation that carries specific legal and social implications, but, within the courtroom, functioned primarily as a categorization based on evidence rather than narrative framing. The verdict reflected the weight of that evidence rather than any singular moment. For those of us involved in the investigation, what remained after the proceedings concluded was not a lesson or a warning, but a record, one that documented how ordinary interactions, when escalated without intervention, can culminate in irreversible outcomes. That record exists in transcripts, exhibits, and archived digital files, preserved not for storytelling, but for accountability. The apartment was eventually cleared and reoccupied, the digital platforms updated, and the case file closed, actions that signify procedural completion rather than resolution in any personal sense. From an investigative standpoint, the work was finished once the evidence had been presented and adjudicated. What remains is the documentation, the confirmation of facts, and the acknowledgement of a life ended at 20 years old, recorded not in speculation or moral commentary, but in verified details that collectively tell the story of what occurred, and nothing beyond that.